My diary, 0600 AM. Driven from wagon lines to gun position. It was sunny, but everywhere wet, damp and muddy. Cancello is a small agricultural town on the great plain that lies on the north bank of the Volturno River. I am in a three-tonner with driver Kit Masters. At 7, we arrive at the gun position. The guns have gone, and all that is left are the M-truck signallers who are there to reel in the D5 lines. This is it, said driver Masters, pulling up in a morass of mud. I leapt from the vehicle and landed knee-deep in it. It's all yours, said Masters, and speeds away like a priest from a brothel. Emerging from holes in the ground are mud-caked troglodytes. I recognise my friend Edgington. "Why, look, Sir Murky," he said in southern negro tones. "Welcome home, Massa Milligan. The young Massa am home. Praise the Lord and hide the silver." "Good God, Edgington, what are you wearing?" "Mud. It am all the rage." "I can't tell you how good it is to be back, mate," I said. "Oh, what a pity. Now we'll never know." I offered him a cigarette. "You must be mad. Why in God's name did you come back?" "I ran out of illness." "Get out. All you got to do is a pee against the Neapolitan Kazi wall and you get crabs." "Where's the guns?" Edgington countenanced himself as a red Indian. "White man gone. Take heap big fire stick and fuck off." More mud-draped figures are issuing from what had been the command post. I suddenly remembered. "Where's all my kit?" "Oh, we had to auction it off. It started to smell." "Don't bugger around," I said. "Everything I treasure in my big pack." Harry shook his head. "Sorry, mate, your big pack has gone AWOL, but your kit bag's safe in G-truck with Al Files." "Well, where's Al Files?" "He's at the new gun position. Last time I saw him, he had the shits. Anyhow, your kit's in his truck." "My big pack lost? It was a major disaster." "You could report it missing, kill in action," said Edgington. "All that I held dear was in there. Things close to a soldier's heart, like socks, drawers, cellar, worst of all, my Nazi war loot, a dagger, an iron cross, an Africa Croix hat, and a set of pornographic photographs taken lovingly from a dead Jerry on Longstop. I was going to send them back to his home. Now, never would his dear mother hold those photographs of three people screwing close to her and say, 'Oh, mine dear son, mine dear son.'" Bombardier Fuller is approaching. "You're just in time. We've got to read in the OP cable." "Oh," I groaned. "I can't do that. I'm convalescing from sandfly fever. They've got all the sand out, but there's still a few flies left." He shoves me forward. "On that bleeding truck," he says. There was no escape. The M-truck signallers start to reel in the line. We travel north along a tree-lined road. Ahead in the distance lie a range of mountains, some snow-capped. These are the ones we shall have to cross to gain access to the Garigliano plain. Jerry has pulled back into them and is waiting. "He knows a good thing when he sees it," said Fuller, looking at them through his war-loot binoculars. October 21, 1943. Reeling in a telegraph line is very simple. A 1,500-weight monkey truck has a hand-operated cable drum on a mount. You walk along, disentangling the line, and the lucky gunner stays on the truck and winds the drum. It was a fiercely contested position. Bribes were offered. Money and cigarettes exchanged hands. It never worked. "I know just how a trained chimp feels," Tikachum was moaning. He was in a ditch, untying the line from a stake. "We're just trained bloody monkeys," he went on. "Once you're caught by a circus, that's it. They can do what they bloody like. Make you ride bicycles, jump through hoops. It's all to humiliate. I never thought I'd see the day when I was performing like a bloody monkey." There were cries of encouragement from the lad. This isn't a war," he considered. "This is bloody chimps. This is a bloody chimps tea party." There's a great cheer. "Hooray!" The end of the line is up a water tower in the grounds of what appears to be an Itai prisoner camp of war. Edgington looked at his watch. "It's exactly 4:45, he informs me. "Oh, good," I said. "I must remember that." The landscape was devoid of any signs of life. All the cattle and farmers had scaparied. "I feel we are the last human beings left alive," Edgington said gloomily. He frequently made such prediction. In post-war years, Harry's brother Doug told of an occasion in the 30s when Harry had predicted the exact date of the end of the world. When the appointed day came and naught happened, Doug felt cheated. He phoned brother Harry and asked what went wrong, and Harry said, I'll give it a couple of days. Harry denies this story. Meanwhile, in Italy, Harry is sent up the tower to unhitch the telephone line. He starts to climb a dodgy ladder. I say dodgy, as the rungs came away as he grabbed them. "Brew up," says Fuller. We adjourn to one of the huts. It's the camp commander's office, now a mess of scattered papers, broken furniture. On the floor, a picture of Mussolini, the glass smashed, footprints over the Duce's kisser, graffiti on the wall. The Hamps were here, the Teberber Tigers. The latter refers to the name they conferred on themselves after a savage action at Teberber in Tunisia. Where are those tigers now? Watching telly, washing up. We make a fire of broken furniture and put on the brew can. We add our graffiti to the walls. Gunner Milligan was here, and we'll make sure he never returns. Someone wrote, "Chelsea FC forever." Such patriotism. Jock Webster, our myopic driver, is ICT. He had a remarkable forehead, bulging like a balloon. Gunner Birch explained, before his bones at Arden, someone put a pump of his arse and blew him up. Why wasn't this man writing the Lancet? Anyhow, Marfick Webster is now putting spoonful of compo mixture into the boiling water. Well, not exactly in, just missing the tin. We reorientate him with left hand down, a bit more, to the right now. How he became a driver is beyond logic. To keep him on the road, his passengers had to shout endless instructions like, "Look out, stop, left hand, right hand." However, he was such a nice bloke, we hated to give him the push, but he broke down so often we had to. "Who thought of out to make compo tea?" Tume asked. "I think," pontificated Fuller, "I think they sweeps the floor of tea factories, put it in the tins and send it to us." We're all squatting around the fire. Some of us sit on broken furniture. Harry is balancing on a huge rococo three-legged chair, which gives him the appearance of a five-legged dwarf. We're all short of fags, but careful Milligan has a whole packet. I'm persuaded to part with some. The method? Manual strangulation. With the sun setting, we reel the last of the line in and set off for the battery. Bombardier Fuller, Tume and Edgington sit silently in the back of the monkey truck. "Monkey truck, that's just a bloody right name for this vehicle," said Gunner Tume, who is now desperately crouching forward, trying, through the shaking, to light a dog end that appears to have three sheds of tobacco in it. He goes on moaning. "Monkeys, that's what we are," he said. "Trained carking monkeys, and this is just one big bloody circus. If only we had an audience," I said, "we could go round with a hat." No one was amused. No, we were all pissed off and bloody cold. We shout through the canvas of the driver's seat, "How much bleeding further, Jock?" "I've no idea," came the Scottish bear. "I have to keep asking the way." And true to his prophecy, he kept stopping to ask the wee. It was an experience to hear him asking the wee from a puzzled Moroccan gumia. "Hurry up, for Christ's sake," said Gunner Edgington. "The cookhouse will be closed." "Wonder what gaff this is," Fuller says, peering out of the back. "We are passing through stone-paved streets with silent locked buildings each side. I guess it must be Capua. Hannibal got this far south with his Carthaginians." "Very good, Milligan," said Edgington. "Go to the top of the class and jump off." "Who were the Carthaginians?" said Bomley Fuller. "It's a third division team from Watford." Edgington is speaking heatedly. It's the only way to keep warm. "How do they expect ordinary London urbans like us to find our way around bloody Italy with half-blind Scots driving us away from bloody Arabs?" "We are in a queue behind a column of Sherman tanks." "Here, I remember this lot." "There's a 7 armoured," said Edgington. "Tanks for the memory," I said. "We are about to cross the Volturno, a slow process." "Oh, Christ, fancy having a queue for the war." Infantry are marching past silently. "They never speak," said Harry. "Don't they ever chat to each other?" "Oh, yes," I said. "What do they say?" "They say, attention, slip arms, charge." We start to move. "I'm really bloody hungry" was a frequent statement, and it came mostly from Edgington. He was known as Hungry Guts. Only one man outdid him, driver Kittel. Kittel, it was said, could smell a sausage at 300 yards and hear a tin of duff being opened a mile away. "What's this? The rattle of boards?" "Here! We're on a bay bridge," said True. "We must be crossing the Volturno." "Ah! The guns! I hear the guns," said Edgington. "We're getting near civilization." "Move over! You trucks get onto the verge, let these tanks go past!" Our legs are starting to get cold. Our bottoms numb, our stomachs empty, our tempers short. There's a gloomy silence. Milligan to the rescue. "My favourite sauce is Worcester," I said. "Worcester?" said Edgington. "Yes." "My favourite is HB," said Tume. "I like OK sauce with bread and cheese," said Fuller. The truck stops on the side of the road. They are lost. With our very battered map and a hand-covered match, we finally get on the right road. We are looking for map square 132832. This was a tree-lined country road just south of Sparanese. The battery are housed in a long irrigation ditch by the side of a road. Spaced about are a few derelict farm buildings. From the dark ditch there comes sound of wallops and groans and furious scratching. The place is alive with mosquitoes. Beating off the beasts, we familiarize ourselves with our surroundings. The guns are adjacent and are already roaring into the night. A red glow is seen. That is what we want. The cookhouse. Soon we are groveling to the cooks. "Where you bloody well been, then?" said Ronnie May, who had been laying in his bivvy, dreaming of some grotty bird in Houndsditch. I had seen her photograph, and the best place to think of her was in a muddy field in Italy. "We've been reeling in a line," said Bomily Fuller. "No one told us to keep any late dinners," said May, starting to wipe a diseased tin opener across his apron. "Good job I kept the oven in," he said. "You should always keep a few late dinners in, Ronnie," said Eddington. "Theatre girls, you know." We're all swiping left, right and centre to throw off the mosquitoes. Let's all put on a fag and smoke them out. Hurriedly we lit up, and forming a circle facing outwards, started to envelop ourselves in clouds of smoke. Soon we were all coughing like consumptives. It alleviated the situation, but as soon as we stopped, the mozzies returned. To help them, Jerry starts lobbing odd shells. Running and eating, we dive into the muddy ditch. There, in the dank dark, we squat and eat mouthfuls of lovely hot stew mixed with dead mosquitoes. "What a terrible position," grumbled Edgerton. "I've eaten many meals," he went on. Mosquito stew? Never." "Eat as many as you can," I said. "Better still, bite them." The rims of our ears were now a mass of red mosquito lumps. Edgerton continues, "You never know. In France, these might be a delicacy like frog's leg." "Ooh, splonk, whoosh, splonk, whoosh, splonk. Jerry is lobbing over 155mm shells that we've been told to avoid. If you like tomato sauce, that tells me you're a Carmen's pull-up eater," I said. "What's wrong with a Carmen's pull-up?" said Tume. "I'll tell you," I said. "It's the tomato sauce. Have you ever looked closely at the bottles? The tops are congealed with dirt and stale tomato sauce. They never wash the bottles out. They just squirt in fresh red crap." "How do you know that, clever dick?" "I know, because I was on a tomato sauce round. We used to go round with a lorry, me and a bloke called Len Brockenbrow. We had great petrol tins full of this red crap and a kerosene oil funnel. We'd stick all the bottles on the deck. I'd hold the funnel. Len would pour out the goo and we'd never once see the bottles clean. I tell you, there was stuff at the bottom of those bottles that was 20 years old. Len told me he once looked down the neck of a bottle and he saw an eye looking up at him." "Was it the manager?" said Edgerton. "Anyways, there's one good sauce that puts on grub, and that's Worcester," I said. "Worcester? That burns the arse off you," said Fuller. "Good," I said. "I always wanted to get rid of mine." Jock Webster interrupts. "None of you ignorant swains has any ideas of sauces. Have you?" "No. I'm an ignorant swain too. But there is a sauce that complements a meal. It's HP. "HP, Harry Pricker," said Harry. "What?" "HP stands for Harry Prickers," he repeated. "I wouldn't stand for that," I said. We plop more shells, but they didn't explode. "Dad," said True. "That or AP. "AP," said Edgerton. "What's he want to fire armor-piercing shells at us for?" "It's the dinner they're after," I said. "Gad, you're right," said Edgerton, immediately seizing on the nonsense. "Once they can get a shell to the crust of British English Army stew, the way is open to pour in reinforcements. In no time they would be behind the back of our cookhouse, cutting off our supply of food and bringing the Army catering corps to its knees." "Imagine," I said, "imagine what fixed-line Spanders could do to Treacle Duff. No, we'd have to surrender. We'd have to haul up the white pudding cloth and hand over the entire plans of our treasured meat and vegetable stew." "For England, the war would be over." "Never," said Harry. "We could go to the colonies, Canada, Australia, and start making meat and veg stew with a new formula, and..." He was cut short by a very close wee splot, another shell. There was a silence broken on by a chorus of mosquitoes. "You're right, Harry," I said. "Yes, I'm just feeling myself to see if that was a direct hit." "No, there's no holes in me, so I'll continue in the service." "Milligan! Bobbin and Milligan!" The voice of our new Akash Sergeant King. "It's no use you keeping silent. I'll find you. The smell will give you away." I give a weak, "I'm here, Sarge," trying to throw my voice in another direction. "Ah, I want you to make out a roster for the command post for the next 24 hours. It's a long midnight. I'm not wanted for any duties, so I must find a place to keep. Eyes now accustomed to the gloom, I see ahead of our trench a group of farm buildings. With blankets and kit, I lumber across to them. Inside, I find a manger. The roof is intact, save for a few slates that rattle when the guns go. A manger? Well, if it was good enough for him. There are a few bales of straw around. Soon I'm lying snuggled down. I'm a bit worried about being above ground with Jerry lobbing over harassing fire, but I gradually fall asleep to the sound of our own 7.2s. October 22nd, 1943. I glance at my watch. Oh, 700 hours. The sun is shining like a spring morn. It had a cheering effect, so I gave 3 cheers. I rose from my straw bed and was soon at the cookhouse for breakfast. The mosquitoes returned to the attack. We ate with gas capes draped over our heads. "Where'd you keep?" said Edgington. I pointed. "Over there!" But Jerry slung over a dozen in the night. "Did they? I didn't hear them. Did they have silencers on?" Poor old Bill True. He was having a crap in the field. The first one landed behind him. He set off and ended up in the ditch with his trousers still down. Good heavens, he might have died from indecent exposure. I heard that Captain Richards of 17th Battery has got the MC. What for? I said. I don't know, said Edgington. It arrived with the Russians, so he pinned it on. And our Johnny Walker's been mentioned in dispatches. Oh, what did he do? Drinking a whole bottle of scotch under heavy mortar fire and never spilled a drop. We all realised as we drank our tea that the guns were silent. Is there a strike? No, said Bombardier Fuller. There's Jerry's in the area, supposed to be massing for an attack, and, so we don't give our position away, we've been ordered to stay silent. Oh, I said, are we talking too loud? He's up there, said Bill True, emerging from under his gas cape, pointing to a hill 4,000 yards away. You mean, I said, he can see us? Yeah, said True. I gave a cheery wave at the hill. Hello, lads! Good luck! Wiedersehen, I called. It was amazing. Jerry could see us, but it wasn't doing anything about it. A strange, uneasy feeling, anticipating a stonks by Jerry. We set up and dug a funk hole in the side of the ditch. A plume of black smoke is ascending from the Jerry position. He's still got fags then, said Edgington. We made a floor out of bits of wood that kept us off the mud. At the same time, we were also involved in digging an alcove for the telephone exchange. Also along the ditch was the command post, cookhouse, officer's mess, and battery office. It looked very much like a World War I trench. An incredible find by Edgington, a huge cupboard that we wedged into our funk hole. We sit inside with the doors closed to avoid the mozzies. At about 19:30, the guns open up again, and we could see ourselves bursting on the hillside behind Sparanese. The sighting of our guns was obviously good, behind a bank of trees that hid them from view, but we gunners walked about the field in full view like silly sods that we were. A big attack is going in tonight. The Grenadiers and the Scots Guards are the poor bastards to do it. They've got to take the hill to our immediate right to deny Jerry observation and put our OP on it. The sirens had gone, and air raid starts on Naples. 04:30 hours. The artillery opened up and fired non-stop until 6:24. Then a silence. From the distant hill, we could hear the dreadful sound of Spandos and Schmeitzers spraying the early morning with bullets, and I can't but wonder at the courage of those lads in the Guards Brigade going forward into it. What a terrible, unexplained lunacy. There must have been a lot of casualties, as there was talk of us having to send grave-digging parties. In the end, they sent some gunners from wagon lines. When they came back, they spoke of Italian civilians being shot out of hand by Germans. There must be a lot of needle between these two nations. I should hate to be a German prisoner thrown to an Italian mob. The mosquito bites and the scratching have turned our faces into what, from a distance, looked like uncured bacon. In desperation, I had rubbed Sloane liniment onto my face, and lo, it kept them away. I've done it, Harry, I said, rushing into the command post with a bottle in my hand. What have you done, said Edgington, turning from the telephone exchange. And if you've done it in that bottle, don't empty it in here. I've stopped the mozzies biting me, I said. How? Said the great man. Sloane's liniment, I said. How in God's name did you get him to drink it? Even as he spoke, I regretted the newfound repellent. My face started to sting and then burn as though it was on fire. I had to plunge my head repeatedly into a bucket of cold water. It was hours before the singing stopped. Wasn't anybody on my side? During the day, there was a story that suddenly, on one of our wireless sets, a German had been heard asking for information. The signaller recognised the accent and said, "Fuck off, Fritz!" The answer was instant, "All right, English bastards, piss off!" Thank God! Naffy today, a tin of 50 fags. With trembling hands we pounced on them, and soon we were wreathed in lung cancer and smoke. I noticed three brass hats with maps walking to a position behind our guns. One carried a shooting stick. He was a tall, dignified man with lots of medal ribbons, or were they laundry marks? I watched as he placed his shooting stick behind him and sat down. There was a pause, then the whole shaft of the stick disappeared slowly into the muddy ground, leaving the owner on his back. Guffaws from all of us. The colonel rose to his feet and shouted, "It's not funny!" And there was a great chorus back, "Oh, yes, it is!" Alf Files had been bed down. He's got the squitters, so we kept our distance. Gunner Roberts and Gunner Ferrier sleep next to each other. Now, Roberts talks in his sleep. Somewhere in the wee hours, he says, "You're next, you're next." Ferrier, half asleep, says, "All right," gets up, gets dressed, and goes on guard. October the 23rd, 1943. Today, non-stop firing. In the command post, there's hardly time to light a fag in between fire orders. A party of our linesmen have nearly been driven mad. They had been reeling in what was an old telephone line. They went on reeling in for 2 miles, only to discover that another battery was in fact reeling it out. Harry came back in M-truck and says, "We're all bloody mad. Fancy, 2 bloody miles of reeling line in, another soppy lot are laying it out. Good job we caught them, otherwise we'd have been on the other side of the bloody Alps by now." The mosquitoes are so bad that an official complaint has been made to the MO, and now 3 engineers with spray guns are going around squirting the countryside and our dinners. It helped a little, but it was far too late. The mosquitoes had left. Why? "They couldn't find any space between the bites," says Fuller, whose face resembled a side of beef with scabs on. Some of the lads' scratches went septic, and they were daubed with some violet stuff that made them look like Red Indians in war paint. They came dancing from the MO's tent with war whoops. October the 23rd, 1943, night. Command post. I sat on a much-treasured wooden box. In front of me, a telephone, a message pad, and the panel control of the tannoy. This last mention connected up a loudspeaker to each gun. Through this you would pass on the command post orders. Me, "Take post." ASAP.
ASAP answering.
BSAP.
BSAP answering.
Me, "Anglosite 92 degrees, range 15,000. The subsections would then all answer back the orders to acknowledge. The OP spotting fall of shot would phone back, "More 3 degrees or add 500 yards, and so on till you hit whatever it was you were after. On this particular shoot, we were trying to silence Nebelwerfers. 6 o'clock, we get the BBC news. The Russians have broken through between Dnipropetrovsk and Chermolk. Large bridgehead created threatening Kiev. Oh, good ski! As we listen, the Naples sirens go. At once, the AK-AK opens up. We duck to our canvas wall and see the sky alive with tracer. It is one of the entertainments of war, a sort of early television. See anything last night? Yes, smashing off our aid in Naples. Oh, are they going to repeat it? We can hear the distant drone of Jerry's planes approaching. We sit tight as they fly overhead. A short, sharp burst of MG fire and a plane bursts into flame. Immediately, a fiery coffin in the sky plunges 1,000 yards south of us, hits the ground and explodes. The grapevine was soon through. "A Jerry! Great!" It crashed near 18 Battery, 100 yards from the battery at Latourine, where the occupants had flung themselves to the ground, shattering their meditations. It was 8:30. My relief was Signaller Thornton. He saunters in. "Evening all. See the fireworks?" Yes, we had seen the fireworks. I bid Lieutenant Wright good night. "Thanks for the help, Milligan. Leave the pencil. It's the only one we've got." I pushed into the dark and stumbled towards where the 10-line exchange was. Behind the canvas blackout flap, I heard Edgington struggling with the calls. "Just a minute. Hey, what? Hold. Oh, sorry, no. Whoops, I'm sorry. Got the wrong line. Hello, 90 Battery here. Who's that? Just a minute. Blast. What the? Hold the line. Hold the line. He sounded like the clue of a Times crossword puzzle. Having trouble, I stood from the outside.
"Go away," he said. "Go a long, long way away."
"Did you hear the plane come down?"
"No, but they're all going to come down sometimes."
It was a German aeroplane.
A-E-R-O-P. "Yes, yes, go away, go away."
"Hello, nobody. What? Hold it. Oh, well, I just... What? Oh, how do you spell that?"
Be, yet know it.
I left him struggling with the war effort and went to our little two-man dugout in the side of the ditch. God, I was weary. I just slipped my boots and jacket off and fell into a deep sleep. October 24, 1943. My diary. Feeling very nervous. Can't eat my food. As day came to an end, I felt really exhausted. What's wrong with me? Another Jerry raid on Naples. October 25, 1943. Morning, medium day, cloudy, chilly, occasional bursts of sun. Good breakfast, drank 3 mugs of tea on the trot, and smoked 3 passing cloud. Most of us are fed up with the new major, Jumbo Jenkins. He's a pain in the arse all over, said Arthur Tume. He's finickety, difficult to contact, you never get near him. He's the product of a spoiled or deprived childhood, and he's playing at soldiers. Every minute he's on fault-finding missions. You can never see him smile. From his driver, Sherwood, we discovered that he's a hypochondriac and carries a small medical chest around with him. Driving along, he suddenly shouts, Stop! Sherwood jams the brakes on. Out leaps Jenkins, lays in the bonnet, and squirts drops up his nose. Directly behind rolls up the jeep of an American general, bleeping his horn. Sherwood puts the car into a gear and drives off the road. The American witnesses a British major laying on his back, putting drops up his hooter, and he wonders why we are allies. Bodies of the German aviators have been found. They're buried by 18 Battery.
You see? 18 Battery again, said Chocua. They get all the bloody fun.
Gunner Devine is passing with a bandage on his head.
There's a curse on 19 Battery, he says solemnly.
A curse? Queries Edgy. What is it?
Fuck 'em, said Devine, a great Liverpudlian grin on his unshaven face.
That is indeed a terrible curse, said Bombery Milligan.
I wonder who put it on us.
It's Jumbo Jenkins. He's the bleeding curse on us, said White.
Fuck him, said Devine.
See, there goes that curse again, said Edgington.
Edgington borrows Files' guitar, and off duty we have a little sing-song in our dugout.
Ah, there you are, says a voice, followed by the body of Sergeant Major Griffin.
A much-beloved Welshman has that half-evil, half-benign smile on his face. Before we can dive for cover, he says, you, and all the points are at me.
We're moving, lads.
A great groan rents the air.
Hey! Oh, cheer up now, he says in a mock cheery voice. The king is going to let you all have a nice shovel and loan for the day.
More terrible groans.
We are going to make some nice little holes in the ground for our guns, aren't we?
Swine. We're all packed off in a 3-tonner. We drive through Sparanese, badly shelled and bombs, some buildings still smouldering. The inhabitants are in a state of shock. Women and children are crying. Men are searching the ruins for their belongings, or worse, their relatives. It was the little children that depressed me the most, that such innocence should be put to such suffering. The adult world should forever hang its head in shame at the terrible, unforgivable things done to the young. Despite all this, the lads strike up a song.
Bang away, Lulu, bang away, Lulu, bang away, good and strong. What are you going to do when you want to blow through when your Lulu's dead and gone?
A line of German prisoners go past. Our wheels splatter them with mud. As usual, we give them the full treatment of raspberries, 2 fingers, and the Heil Hitler salutes. They don't even bother to look back. They trudge on, all in step.
Lucky sods, it's all over for them, said Gunner White.
The new position is a small flat area, about a couple of miles north of our last position, behind a railway bank, with rising wooded ground behind us. Again, we are to use a dried-up stream bed to install ourselves. It's very much like the last position. My diary describes that day thus. Evening. On forward recce. Nice, deep, dry stream bed for all personnel. Most of the night spent digging. Can hear mortars putting up some hot fire. Slept like a dead man. Awoke would stand to 4:30 a.m. We are still digging. No Jerry shelling today. 1 or 2 odd ones, maybe. Wrote to Mum and Dad. Heavy ACK batteries moving in around us. October 26, 1943. No sleep. Feeling tired. During the day, the guns arrived and spread themselves about in their unexplainable pattern. 2 were ahead of us and 2 behind us with their backs to the wood. The command post was not to the liking of the major.
He doesn't like it, said Chalky White. Nobody likes a command post. You don't see soldiers going around and say, I like command posts.
He says it's not big enough anyhow.
All hell is let loose. Ak-Ak start blazing away. We all go head first to the deck. A swarm of Emmys roar over the position at 0 feet. We hear the Major shouting, "Tommy guns! Tommy guns!" A laconic voice, "Tommy guns is on leave, sir." Eddington is the first to rise to his feet. "Any question?" he says. He knelt over me, made a sign of the cross, and then started to feel my pockets for fags. I am notoriously ticklish, and using one hand to tickle and convulse me, the other hand withdrew my fags. There followed a friendly struggle, during which Major Jenkins appeared and said, "What is going on? This isn't a nursery. Bombardier, you ought to know better. Get these men on with the digging." I jumped up and yes-sirred him on his way. He's back before we stopped giggling. "Did any of you men fire at those planes?" he said. "We admit we didn't," I explained. "It's not easy to shoot down planes with shovels, sir." "Well, you will keep your sidearms within reach next time. I expect to hear a volley."
"Very good, sir."
In an hour, the planes flew over, and we let fly. The Major is running up and down, waving his arms.
No, bloody fool, they're ours, they're ours."
"Don't worry, sir. When they fly back again, we all apologize," I said.
He didn't know how to take me. He stood there, clenching his fist, his face a mask of frustration. It was a mixed day of planes. First Jerry, then the RAF, then Jerry, then the RAF. The Ak-Ak boys took no chances and fired at a lot of them. The Major was nearly out of his mind by day's end, trying to coordinate all our efforts for maximum retaliation. Late that night, we heard him mournfully playing Schubert's Serenade on his clarionet. Smudger Smith on A subgun answered it by howling like a dog. "Ow!" The Major sent Gunner Woods, his batman, to find out who the offender was. As fast as he silenced one howl, another one would start somewhere else. The payoff was an actual farm dog behind us who took up the howling and nobody could stop him. Oh, that night. Had we not learnt our lesson of not occupying empty stream beds, gullies, etc.? No, we hadn't. So, and lo, it raineth. By morning, we had all learnt our lessons of not occupying, etc., etc., and were mud-covered and ankle-deep in it. The Major, with memories of the Somme, ordered a mile of duckboards. Meanwhile, we attempt to scrape the mud off. We carved it off with jackknives like dough. Sergeant Donaldson dries the mud with a blowtorch and breaks it off with a hammer, but not before setting his trousers alight. The duckboards arrived. Good heavens, it's white pine wood, which stood out like a mark for all Jerry planes to bomb. And sure enough, the day after, there's a sudden roar of planes, Ak-Ak guns shooting everyone up the arse, Jerry machine gunning for all his worth, all of us running in all directions, down holes, up trees, behind walls, under lorries, all in split seconds. We looked like early Keystone Cop movies. Major Jenkins had emptied his Webley pistol at the raiders and dropped it in the mud.
"Listen, all you lot," it's Sergeant King talking in his clipped nasal cockney voice. "These duckboards have been adjudged as too conspicuous. Therefore, we must go a-trampling on them until they match the rest of Italy."
The rest of the day we spent stamping in the mud and then stomping it onto the duckboards. What fun!
"If my mother knew I was doing this, she'd go and shoot Churchill."
"How?" said Gunner White, looking down at the brown sea. "How can we get out of this before we all go stark, raving, bloody mad?"
He looked up to heaven and said, "God, save us from all this fucking around." The position became known as the Wembley Exhibition. "I've got a culinary surprise, lads," said Bombardier Spike Deans. He had just come off command post duty. The hour is 0600. None of us are pleased by the awakening.
"Why, in God's name, do we, the innocent of this parish, have to be aroused at this unearthly bloody hour?"
Deans taps the sides of his nose with his finger, but nothing falls out. He gives a sly wink. "It's to the lucky one's advantage. Tonight, in Funko number 3, I'll be preparing a repast that I am willing to offer at 5 fags ago." There is a general stirring at this announcement.
"What's the grub?" says Bleary Eyed Edgington.
"Never mind what it is. It will be better than what the cookhouse gives you. It will be served at 20 hundred dollars. There's enough for 5 portions, and so saying, he exited.
5 fags is a lot to swap for dinner, I said.
"Yeah," said Birch. "Suppose we don't like the grub. Do we get the fags back?"
A guffaw from Chalky White follows.
"You're joking. If I know Deans, he's only doing this because he's short of snouts." "I've had enough of Compo Grub. I'll chance it," says Edgington, arising from his mud-encrusted blankets. "Me too," said Bombardier Milligan. "I'm trying to cut down on fags and build up on food."
"I'll help you cut down on fags," said Gunner White, who was pulling on a pair of underpants so perforated they looked like piano rolls. "I'll smoke yours for you."
Throughout the day, we got that which the farmers in Sahara were dying for. It poured, it trickled through every aperture. The rim of my tin hat was a hanging ring of pear-shaped watery pearls. A merry game. Turn your head, see if you can make them run around the rim without letting any drop off. A Catholic priest visited us this evening and asked if anyone wanted confession and Holy Communion. I nearly went, but since the war started, my belief in God had suffered a reverse. I couldn't equate all the killing by two sides, both of whom claimed to be Christian. I was, as Gary Cooper would say, kind of mixed up inside. Talking of mixed up inside brings us to the Dean's evening gastronomique. He had cooked it in half a kerosene oil tin, which now sat over a fire of diesel. "It's got carrion," he warned. Gunners Edgington, White, Birch, Bomberly Fuller, myself sat expectantly squeezed in the dugout. "Right," said Deans. From the tin of boiling water appears a giant suet roll which he has boiled in the sleeve of an old vest. He places it on a piece of wood. "Who's first?" he says. We all haul out our tins. He cut a slice off the roll. From it oozed a curry-strained gravy with what looked like thin French beans and Dobie's Foursquare tobacco. With the first mouthful, I let out a scream. It was like eating raw chilies. "Too hot, is it?" inquired Dean. I lay rolling on the ground. "I'll break it down a bit," he said, and started mixing in hot water, turning the whole thing into a ghastly-looking death-grey colour. Or was it death brown? What's this stringy stuff?" said Munching Edgington. "That," said Deans, "that is grass." There was a shocked silence, Edgington and his mouth still open with a shock. "Grass," he said. "Grass?" "Don't get angry," said Deans. "It's grass, but specially selected." "Yes," said Edgington, "specially selected for bloody idiots like us. I'm not giving you five fags for bloody grass. I mean, I can graze free with the bloody cows. Look, if you think you've been diddled, okay, but answer the question. Until Trotsky here," he pointed to Edgington, "asked what it was, you were still enjoying it all, weren't you? Believe me, in the Maritime Alps, this dish is considered a delicacy." "Well, it did taste okay, really, and by now the cookhouse would be closed, so basically we had no option." "But," Birch added, "we should have been given a warning."
"Oh, a warning? I wanted it to be an element of surprise in it."
"Oh, we were fucking surprised, all right," said White, who then broke the bad news. "And I've got a surprise for you. I haven't got any fags."
"You sod," said Deans. White grinned.
"All life is 6-4 against," he said.
A head pokes in the dugout. It's Ben Wenham.
The news is on in the command post."
We all rushed there to hear the BBC announcer saying, "Heavy rain and conditions underfoot are slowing the Allied advance in Italy."
"Good heavens. It's raining here then," said Edgington, putting on an idiot grin.
It's strange, you know. He never mentioned it.
Mentioned what? He never mentioned that in Italy we silly buggers had curry grass for dinner.
I was on command post duty from 8:30. The weather had stopped the war. There was no firing save a few pre-planned harassing fire tasks. I wrote a letter home, then played battleships with Lieutenant Wright, a slight, dark-eyed, gentle-faced young man who looked as out of place in the war as Quasimodo in the Olympic high jump finals. Wait, supposing he won? We had the 22 set beamed onto Allied Forces Network, now operating from Naples. I remember that night how nostalgic I got when just before midnight they started to play Duke Ellington's Riverboat Shuffle. Wow, wow, the jazz. Outside, I went knee-deep into the water and did my own riverboat shuffle back to my dugout. My bed was raised on two large empty 80-pound potato tins. Edgington was awake, writing a 10,000-page love letter to his beloved Peg. "Still up," I said.
"No," he said. "It went down an hour ago."
He took the fact from his mouth. "I'm drawing on my last reserves of energy," he said. "Very quiet at the command post tonight," I said, as I stood my boots off. I beat Major Wright 3-0 at battleships.
Oh, if that gets around, he could be cashiered, said Edgington.
I pulled myself wearily under my blankets. Hadn't I better rephrase that? I fell asleep, leaving sexually frustrated Edgington trying to work it out in writing. He certainly had a lot of lead in his pencil. Hadn't we all?